Hi, and welcome to Last Man Standing. Me, Paul Stevenson. This is the 29th of May, 2020. Hope you all had a great weekend. Do support us, of course. Go to the homepage of Public Broadcasting Network, publicbroadcasting.org, and you can find where you can, because we do need support, obviously. We're 100% listener supported. Well, almost. We do have some advertisers, but mostly it's our listeners. So I'll be with you for the next hour, and I'm going to crack on because I've got a very important guest tonight, I think, because recently we've done shows and certain themes keep coming up, whether we're discussing Zionism or Christian Zionism, or someone calls in who's clearly a dispensationalist or whatever. The similar themes keep coming up about Israel and the fulfillment of that land, and about prophecies about the return of the Jews to the land and the rebuilding of temples and Revelation, and of course with COVID and with the Ukraine-Russia situation, the prophets have gone into overdrive, and they're pretty busy at the best of times. So I thought it'd be a great time to get an expert on eschatology, and to my mind, he's probably, I don't know anyone better. Maybe Steve Gregg's up there with him. I have Gary DeMar with me, and Gary's a Christianologist. I guess he probably is best known for his work on eschatology, although he has written a lot of books. Last year I read his book, God and Government, which was just fantastic, and he's written several books on eschatology. The most comprehensive one, the one I think that I would recommend to anybody, is Last Days Madness. He's also written The Rapture and the Fig Generation, or The Fig Tree Generation, Wars and Rumors of Wars. He writes a hell of a lot. He's very prolific on GaryDeMar.com and American Vision. And I think he's got a new podcast now called Heavy Lifted. So I always say to Gary, I don't know where he gets the time for these things, but Gary, you're very welcome. And how are you, sir?
I'm doing well. Last year was a kind of an adventure. I ended up having a cancerous growth on my left kidney, so I had my left kidney removed last January. But other than that, everything's been pretty good.
Well, I'm really sorry to hear that, but I didn't know, and I'm glad you've made a full recovery. I presume, do you have you?
Oh yeah. I mean, it's you know, you can live without two kidneys, and you typically what ends up happening is your remaining kidney actually increases in size and function about 25%. I haven't really, I've told people, hey, if I had been in a coma and someone woke me up and said, hey, you know, 2 years or a year ago, you ended up losing your kidney, I wouldn't know, because I haven't seen any biological effects of me losing that kidney. So other than a couple of scars here and there, I haven't really had any impact at all. It hasn't had any impact at all on me in that way.
Okay, well, I'm really glad that you're fully recovered, and I wish you the best of health going forward, Gary. Right, so those topics that keep coming up, I mean, you've covered a lot of these in Last Days Madness, including... Let's start with, because, I mean, obviously, I would consider you an expert in this stuff. I would know, in my experience, I guess, in talking to people, I maybe know more than a lot of people. But I don't know anywhere near the extent of, you know, I haven't had my head in this stuff as often or as to the extent that you have, obviously. But one thing that always strikes me when you're talking to a dispensationalist is their arguments are always tend to be absolutely devoid of the issue of timing. For example, prophecies about the Jews being returned to that land are often prophecies that precede when the Jews were returned to that land, for example. But you probably know it off the top of your head. If you can just give us a few prophecies, for example, that dispensationalists like to use to talk about, you know, the return of the Jews to that land and the temple being rebuilding, which we would understand and have already been fulfilled.
Well, what's interesting about this, a true dispensationalist, I mean, somebody who is really what we would call an orthodox dispensationalist, has to maintain that there are actually no prophecies prior to the rapture that have anything to do with Israel. And this is something that a lot of dispensationalists don't know, and this is something that a lot of people who espouse the dispensational point of view, who talk about the significance of prophecies taking place right now, don't know their own system. Because the dispensationalist system maintains that we are now living in what is called a parenthesis, that we are in a church age, and that the prophecy clock regarding Israel has stopped. And we are, what's going to happen is when the so-called rapture takes place, when Jesus invisibly returns and takes the church off the earth, that's when the prophecy clock starts again. And then there's going to be this 7-year period.
You're talking about Daniel and the prophecies in Daniel.
Yeah, Daniel 9 and the 70 weeks, and they'll say at the end of the 69th week, the prophecy clock stopped, and something called the church age started, and the church was not at all mentioned in the Old Testament. It's a brand new redemptive program, and we're living within that time frame right now between the end of the 69th week, 483 years, and the 70th week, which starts up again when the rapture supposedly takes place, and then 7 years follow.
So all right, let me just stop you, because there's two big issues here that our listeners are going to find really interesting. Where do they get this from, that this prophetic clock stops after the 69th week? And also, where do they get it that the idea that the church has never spoke about, that it's a new entity? Because from our understanding, we've already spoken that the same word ecclesia is used in the Old Testament and is used in the New Testament. Those two points are key for anybody listening to understand.
Well, there is no text. There is no text that you can point to that would support that there's a gap between the 69th and the 70th week. Daniel 9 starts off with Daniel reading Jeremiah's prophecy about the 70 years of captivity, and they were coming up on the 70th year. And then you get this prophecy of 70 weeks of years, and there was no gap between in any time during the 70 years of captivity. So all of a sudden, why would you then now have a gap between the 69th and 70th week of years? It makes absolutely no sense. There's nothing in the text itself that says anything that there's going to be a gap. So that's the first thing. And, you know, anytime I always talk to somebody about this, I would say, show me a verse that says that there is a gap between the 69th and 70th week. And of course, they can't come up with one. In fact, if you were to look at every time a indicator of numbers is given, you know, 7 days, 3 days, 4 days, 40 years, 40 days, and so forth, there isn't a single example in the entire Bible when a specific number of days, years, months, or years is given that there is a gap, that there is a postponement of some of those years, and then the other years are pushed into the future. This would be the only place that that's the case, and I don't think, again, there's anything mentioned of a gap there at all. Go ahead. You go ahead.
Well, so it's an unjustified departure from the norms of hermeneutics and exegesis of the scripture.
Oh, exactly. And this is, and what's remarkable about this, this is from a prophetic system that claims to interpret the Bible literally. and so here you have a non-literal gap and a separation between 483 years and 7 years and a period of time of almost 2,000 years. I mean, imagine that, 2,000 years. So this means, see, since this gap that we're in right now was not predicted in the Old Testament according not predicted at all, therefore, the rapture has always been described as an any moment event. That the rapture is always imminent. That could take place at any time in history, which means that the so-called rapture could have taken place 60 years ago, 70 years ago, 100 years ago, 200 years ago, 300 years ago, 1500. In fact, the rapture could have taken place any time in the history of the Book of Acts. That is the position, that is the dispensational position, and that there are no signs during this period where the rapture could take place at any moment. So anyone who says that Israel becoming a nation again in 1948 was prophetically significant does not understand dispensationalism. And what's curious about all this, Paul, is that I have a cassette tape here. For those people who don't know what a cassette tape is, it's a recording tape on tape, a little rectangular box, and it has a tape inside and so forth. And it is of an interview. It was actually a debate interview that I did with Dr. Paige Patterson on May 15th, 1991. And providentially, it's been sitting here for a while on I think it was on a Dallas radio show. Now, Paige Patterson, who was a big wig in the Southern Baptist Convention, Southern Baptist Church here in the United States, a very big name, very popular name, he understood this in my debate with him. And he actually says that Israel in the land today has no prophetic significance because Israel has to be brought back believing. And secondly, there can be no prophetic sign this side of the rapture of the church. So any dispensationalist today who's claiming that all these signs are a lead up to the rapture of the church does not know what he or she is talking about in terms of dispensationalism.
Yeah, you're right to point out that inconsistency. For anybody who acknowledges that inconsistency, that would remove a lot of books on prophecy from the shelves, because they indulge in all these signs that are apparently leading up to these things. The other thing, apart from being an aberration in terms, like we said, about this 69th week and all other things that dispensationalists impose, it's also aberrant in church history. It needs to be pointed out. Most of the church did not believe these things. And in fact, you know, there are basic theological concepts and eschatological concepts that, from my understanding, have been accepted and understood for centuries. And dispensationalism, despite its popularity today and many thinking that this is the only view, is actually an aberrant eschatological position, correct?
Oh, it is. It's really a 19th century invention. Some people will go through history and they'll try to find elements that you will find common with dispensationalism. And what they'll do is they say, well, this is kind of a baby version of dispensationalism. And what happened is the church, as it developed its doctrine, it came into a full flowering of what dispensationalism is all about. You're right. You won't find anything in history that is very specific in terms of dispensationalism as it's taught today. And then you asked the question about, okay, how did they come up with this doctrine? And they will admit, if you find an honest dispensationalist, if you look at a lot of the works of, say, John Walvoord or Pentecost and some others, they will tell you that it was a theological necessity for this idea that the prophetic clock stopped and that God is going to deal with Israel in the future. And what we have right now is something called the church age. Because according to the dispensationalists and their theological position on this, God will not deal with the church and Israel at the same time and in the same place. So in order for God to deal with Israel again, the church has to be taken off the earth so God can once again deal with Israel for this final 7 years. And that is just completely made up.
Fiction.
It is. Look, all you have to do is read the book of Acts. Acts chapter 2, there were Jews living in Jerusalem from every nation under heaven. So the gospel goes to Israel first. I mean, if you go back to Matthew chapter 10, Jesus says, look, only go through the cities of Israel. The gospels are all about Israel's eschatology, not the world's eschatology, Israel's eschatology. So Mark 13, Matthew 24, 25, Luke 21, that's Israel's eschatology. You get into the book of Acts. What happens on Pentecost? The gospel is being preached to the nation of Israel, Jews living in Israel from every nation under heaven. So who made up the first century ecclesia, translated church. Jews did. The first mention of the of ecclesia in the book of Acts is in Acts chapter 5. And who makes up this church? They're all Jews. They're Israelites. And you really don't find the idea of the gospel going to the Gentiles until Acts chapter 9 and 10, and then finally at the Jerusalem Council in chapter 15. So there is this idea that there is a gap in time, and the prophetic time, the prophetic clock has stopped, is just plain nonsense. And there are no specific verses that teach it. I always ask somebody, show me a verse in the Bible that says that the church will be taken off the earth before, during, or after a 7-year period. Just all I need is one verse. And they'll say, well, there's no verse for the Trinity either. I said, well, that's not an argument. This is the linchpin of your system. This is the position that makes dispensationalism, and yet there isn't a single verse that says anything about this. They'll go to 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. Well, 1 Thessalonians 4 doesn't say anything about the rise of Antichrist. It doesn't say anything about a tribulation period. It doesn't say anything about the Daniel's prophecy. None of that. Traditionally, 1 Samuel chapter 4 has been viewed as what we would call a second coming passage. The rapture is not the same as the second coming. So the whole thing is really fictional. And I think more and more people are beginning to realize this. And so anyway, there are no verses for this. And again, I ask,
it's almost like something, more akin to like Mormonism or something.
Well,
in terms of some of it's the way it's just, they just made it up.
Yeah. And you've noticed that during the 19th century, you have all the apocalyptic cults took place. You got Mormonism, Jehovah's Witnesses, and Seventh-day Adventism, as well as dispensationalism. All prophetic cults had their start in the 19th century. Now, that isn't necessarily a causal relationship, but there is this preoccupation among these divergent groups on eschatology. It's the essence of their system, dispensationalism. The essence of dispensationalism is, in fact, the eschatological aspect to it. While they can believe other things that you and I would agree with, when it comes to prophecy, they are just way, way off base.
There's a lot of leaven in there.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
I mean, one thing that struck me when you look at all this, when you get down into it, whether they're aware of it or whether they care about it, in fact, I think some of them think it's a good thing. Dispensationalists are thinking a lot like the rabbis do, rather than what Christians have typically thought when they're come to understand these things. Would you agree with that?
Well,
like a lot of an understanding of certain texts and things about the temple and this type of thing, just general overview stuff of.
Well, it's always amazed me. There's so much focus on the rebuilding the temple, reinstituting animal sacrifices again, reinstituting circumcision again,
you've got the whole Hebrew roots movement.
Yeah, you have that. But what you've done here is you've made unbelieving Israel the focus of redemptive history, when Jesus is the focus of redemptive history. There's so much emphasis upon the Antichrist, and yet the focus of history is Jesus Christ. If you get the definition of an Antichrist, this is another thing I do. I say, give me a biblical definition of Antichrist. And people say, well, somebody who opposes Jesus Christ. I said, that's not the biblical definition of Antichrist. An Antichrist is someone who denies that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh. That's a theological definition. So who was John talking about? John wasn't talking about a political figure. In fact, he makes it very clear, he's not talking about a single entity. There were many Antichrists in John's day. And John goes on to say, and it's this, the fact that there are many Antichrists, that it was evidence that it was the last hour. And so you can see that in 1 John chapter 2 verse 18, You can see it in 2 John chapter 7, where the biblical definition of Antichrist is. A biblical Antichrist was someone who denied that Jesus Christ had come in the flesh. These were
most
apostates
likely referring to the but also he might have been talking about Gnostics at the time, which believed that Jesus.
That would have been that would have been later. You read the book of Acts, who did Paul have more trouble with? He didn't have trouble with Rome. The only time, until you got much, much later, but basically the only time Rome stepped in to this is when the Jews came to Rome and brought false charges against the Apostle Paul and Silas and so forth. This was done at the hands of the Jews. Who wanted to kill Paul? It wasn't the Romans who wanted to kill Paul. It was the Jews who wanted to kill Paul. There was actually they took an oath, and finally word got out, and Paul ends up escaping secretly. But all the way through the book of Acts, it was the apostate, unbelieving Jews who attacked Paul. And at the same time, though, the first believers were in fact Jews. Thousands of Jews embraced Jesus as the Messiah. In fact, I think it's in chapter 19, where again there are the apostate Jews. Let me see if I can pick this up real quick here. This is at Corinth, and it says, this is verse 12. But while Gallio was proconsul of Achaia, the Jews with one accord rose up against Paul and brought him before the judgment seat. This is just like Jesus, how the Jews manufactured charges against Jesus and turned them into political charges. Pilate wasn't concerned about Jesus' religious views. He was only concerned about political views. And so they made Jesus into be an insurrectionist. He's not to pay taxes to Caesar, which was all a lie. So it goes on, verse 13, saying, here's what the Jews said. This man persuades men to worship God contrary to the law. But when Paul was about to open his mouth, Gallio said to the Jews, if it were a matter of wrong or a vicious crime, O Jews, it would be reasonable for me to put up with you. But if there are questions about words and names and your own law, look after it yourselves. I am unwilling to be a judge of these matters. And he drove them away from the judgment seat. And they all took hold of the Jews. They all took hold of Sosthenes, the leader of the synagogue, of the judgment seat. And Gallio was not concerned about any of these things. I mean, that's straight from Scripture. The Romans wanted Pax Romana. They wanted the Roman peace. The Jews knew this. The apostate, unbelieving Jews, who were the antichrists of the day, made up in terms of what John writes in the book of Revelation, the synagogue of Satan, and they pursued Paul on religious grounds, but used political arguments in order to try to draw the Romans into this and to turn this into a political issue so that they could get rid of Paul. But Rome early on wouldn't have anything to do with it.
Yeah, Jesus 2.0 job, basically. It worked. It worked with Jesus, so they repeated it.
But you see, remember that the difference is Pilate made a strategic error. He says, what I'll do here is I'll leave it up to the people to make a decision regarding this Jesus. And he said, and of course the crowd, it was a manufactured crowd. This wasn't the people generally. These were the religious leaders. And then of course throughout you want me to crucify your king. And think about what they cried out. We have no king but Caesar. And so the later on in the book of Acts, there is no appeal to the people. The Roman government is making a decision. Now, it helped in Acts chapter 16, and I think Acts 21, and then in Acts 19, that Paul was a Roman citizen, and he used his Roman citizenship in order to gain traction in terms of the kingdom. And by the way, as an aside here, Christians out there who don't want to get involved in politics and don't see their citizenship as important, it's Now, what the Apostle Paul, appealed to his Roman citizenship and used it to his advantage in order to get the message out and also to gain freedom throughout the Roman Empire in order to spread the gospel.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Before I go on to a little bit more about the temple, just go back a little bit, because you said rightly, from my understanding, that the whole focus is, you know, is with dispensationalists and this whole system is on Israel. And yet the irony is those of us who believe what Christians have believed for the best part of 2,000 years are accused of replacement theology, which is a pejorative that dispensationalists use, that the church has somehow replaced Israel. And they of course, you know, people like Mark Hitchcock and Paul Wilkinson and Jack Hibbs and these guys, they would even call you a heretic. I've heard these guys use this term, but we wouldn't call it replacement theology. We would call it what, supersessionism or remnant theology. And again, it's back to this, I suppose, for our listeners, and this is what keeps coming up. Who and what is Israel? Because that has been understood. Paul has outlined this and explained it at length. And again, these basic theological concepts of Israel, the spiritual Israel, the remnant, they have been lost through this dispensationalist thing. Just talk to that a little bit, Guy, please.
Yeah, we've been accused of this, and this is akin to the pulling the race card. You know, when you don't have a good theological argument, you play an emotional card and call, you know, you guys believe in replacement.
Well, they do actually. In this case, they use the anti-Semite card.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, Hal Lindsey wrote a book years ago called The Road to Holocaust. If you don't believe what dispensationalists believe, then you believe that the in a future Holocaust. And now they stop saying this. They stop saying this. And I debated Michael Brown on this very question about replacement theology, and he actually agreed with me on my theological take on this. And let me just describe this very, very shortly and succinctly. As I already mentioned, the first believers were Jews. These first believers were Jews. The first ecclesia was made up exclusively of Jews. It was only later on that Gentiles were grafted into an already existing ecclesia. And it's unfortunate that the King James translation of the Bible translated ecclesia as church, rather than the, following the Tyndale translation, where Tyndale translated ecclesia as assembly or congregation. Because you get to Acts chapter 7, and Stephen talks about the ecclesia in the wilderness. And the King James actually translates it as the church in the wilderness. You also see in Hebrews chapter 2, where the psalmist is referenced and talks about the ecclesia. So this idea that somehow the church is a new entity, and you brought this up already, that the Old Testament, when the Old Testament was translated from Hebrew into Greek, the Greek translation of the Hebrew kahal was translated as ecclesia. And I have a Hebrew New Testament, and when the Hebrew New Testament, you will read that when you come across ecclesia, it's translated as a kahal. So no one saw the word ecclesia as anything special in terms of two distinct redemptive peoples. There was one redemptive people. They belonged to the ecclesia. And Jews were first. Gentiles were grafted in. So this idea...
This would be the remnant. This would be a small percentage, really. Those who follow Jesus and his ministry, you know, and those who were always faithful to the law. And then they continued being faithful to Christ. And then
Look, the Old Testament is our guide here. Not every Jew in the Old Testament was a believer. No. So why would we expect the same thing in the New Testament? Jesus had more trouble with the Jewish religious leaders of his day than he did the Romans. I mean, this does call out Herod, but Herod wasn't a Roman. He counters the religious leaders of the day.
I really think this is where the confusion lies. I mean, it's a bit like, I don't know, today you see the same thing. I mean, there are a lot of people who claim to be Christians, you know, and even down through history, you have the institutional church of the Catholic Church. And amongst that, you had people who were doing their best to be faithful to Christ, but largely, like in ancient Israel, it was a harlot.
Yeah. I mean, that you're absolutely right. I mean, that's what the Babylonian image in the book of Revelation describes this adultery that took place. That's what the book of Hosea is all about. Ezekiel describes the same type of thing. So this idea that you had a pure believing Jewish race in the New Testament is just nonsense. But the first believers, in fact, were Jews. To the Jew first, Gentiles were grafted in. The first ecclesia was made up exclusively of Jews. So this idea that the church replaces Israel, that there's no such indication at all in here. I don't like to use the idea that the church is Israel now. I think that's kind of confusing to people.
It is because of the modern state of Israel. But Paul would affirm that, wouldn't he? Really, that.
He wouldn't have used that language. He would have said that not all Israel is Israel. I think he was saying there. Look, not all the people who are ethnic Israelites are in fact Israelites. And you have to, if you really want to be a true Israelite, you have to embrace Jesus Christ as your promised Messiah. That's what this is all about. And Gentiles, and I think a lot of the reason that there was so much animosity among Jews, Jews who came to Christ were upset because they believed that the Gentiles would have all of the promises that were made to Israel. They wanted to keep this distinction between Jewish believers and Gentile believers, where Jewish believers had a specialized position in terms of God's redemptive history. But Ephesians 2 blows that out of the water. There's one new man in Christ. The dividing wall has been broken down. So this idea that somehow there are two peoples of God, you need a rapture to do all this. Now, let's go back to Lindsay's book, The Road to Holocaust. And he was saying that anybody who doesn't hold this two peoples of God position and doesn't hold that God has a redemptive future for Israel in the history has a real problem. And you don't hear about this much anymore because people like me have in fact made mention of this. In my debate with Michael Brown, could not answer this, and I said, Dr. Brown, you maintain that during this 7-year period, God's going to deal with Israel again, but according to the Zechariah chapter 13, 2/3 of the Jews living in Israel during this great tribulation period are going to be slaughtered. So how is it that God waits 2,000 years to deal with a future generation of Jews, then allows an Antichrist to come up and almost to kill all the Jews and slaughter them into what is considered to be a future Holocaust? And that's the kind of language that Ryrie and Walford and these other dispensationalists describe. This Jack Van Empe. They all talk about bloodbath and so forth in the future. So again, people say, well, after the rapture, God's going to deal with Israel again. Well, I remind people, God's going to deal with Israel again according to your system, but he's going to allow 2/3 of them to be slaughtered. How is that then not the true road to Holocaust, which was the name of Lindsay's book?
Yeah, I have to say I listened to that debate, and I've heard other debates that Dr. Brown's done on this issue, and if I'm being absolutely blunt about it, I'm not sure that Dr. Brown is 100% sold out to Christ. I think he's holding on to some of his Jewishness, but I can only speculate about that. The other thing I wanted to mention, it's back to the prophecies, and this is such a big one. I've been through the New Testament. I don't see any prophecies about the Jews being returned to that land. And in fact, on the contrary, and I don't see any prophecies about the temple being rebuilt either. If you could address those as I brought them up, because the whole issue of the abomination of desolation standing in the holy place is also a verse that is controversial. But let's talk to the the actual prophecies or lack of.
Let's deal with what the New Testament doesn't say, since you made that key point. And you will find dispensational writers, and I've written on this as well. Anybody who's interested in my Wars and Rumors of Wars, Last Days Madness, and the Rapture and the Fig Tree Generation, there is not a single verse in the New Testament that says anything about another rebuilt temple. Let's keep in mind that the Old Testament does, in fact, predict that the temple is going to be rebuilt. And sure enough, it was. And then it was in disrepair during the period of Antiochus Epiphanes. Herod comes along and he starts the rebuilding process, and it was finally completely rebuilt in around 8, I think it was finally finished and dedicated in AD 64. Then it was destroyed in AD 70. Jesus had predicted that. There isn't a single verse in the New Testament that says there's going to be another rebuilt temple. This is another one of these necessity defenses that, the reason we have to have a rebuilt temple because we have to back to Daniel's 70 weeks of years in the 70th week. During that 7-year period, you got to have a temple. You got to have an Antichrist, which Daniel 9 doesn't say anything about an Antichrist. So again, this is a position that when put under the theological exegetical microscope, I said, where is it? I don't see it on the slide anywhere. Not a single verse in the New Testament says anything about a rebuilt temple. The abomination of desolation, if you look at Matthew chapter 24:15, notice the audience reference. When you see the abomination of desolation, and all you have to do is follow, and don't even begin in chapter 24. Begin in chapter 21 and follow the second person plural through Matthew 21, Matthew 22, Matthew 23, Matthew 24, and you will see that the second person plural refers to the people of that era, does not refer to some future generation. Even the religious leaders of Israel in chapter 21 was very specifically said Jesus was talking about them. He wasn't talking about something in the distant future. So the abomination of desolation, Luke describes it a little differently. He says, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then you know that its desolation is near. So you pull those two things together. I don't think Jerusalem surrounded by armies isn't the abomination that causes the desolation. It was just an event that took place as something that could be visibly seen. Luke is writing to a more general, probably Greek Roman audience. Matthew is probably writing mostly to a Jewish audience. Mark is the same way. But the abomination that causes desolation was something theological, and it probably had to do with the fact that the Jews were still using the outdated temple, the rejection of Jesus as the promised Messiah, animal sacrifices and such, which is in fact were by this time abominations, because the true Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world, the true high priest, and the true temple was already in their midst, and therefore their acts were committing abominable acts because they had rejected Jesus as the fulfillment of all those prophecies.
Which, interestingly, would be what they would still be doing if they were to rebuild the temple, and you have Christians supporting that, which would be a complete rebellion and an abomination towards Christ.
Exactly. And they would, I suppose they would admit that that's the case. But then again.
And they call us heretics?
I know. Then think, Paul, what you have to do here. So when you get into the supposed 1,000-year reign of Jesus on the earth, they claim that there's going to be another temple and actual animal sacrifices for atonement. That's their position. Now they'll say memorial. It doesn't say memorial. It says for atonement. And I asked a professor. He's retired now, professor at Dallas Theological Seminary, about the idea whether or not a circumcision would be reinstituted during the 1,000-year reign of Christ on the earth. And he said, well, I guess so, because that's what Scripture says. So you're right. This is a Judaizing corruption of the gospel, where Jesus is the fulfillment. He's the temple. He's the Lamb of God. He's the high priest. He's everything that the Old Testament was in a typological form. He is the fulfillment of all of those things. And yet what the dispensationalists want to maintain and said, yeah, that's true, but God has to deal with Israel again. Well, yeah, God's going to deal with Israel again, but according to your system, two-thirds of them are going to be slaughtered. I mean, it makes absolutely no sense. And when the typical, general in the pew Christian hears my assessment of these things, and many of them just plain shocked, they've never heard this before.
And yeah, I've had the same reaction. I've had people who, who have rebuked me aggressively, that I'm some kind of heretic and that, I need to stop listening to weird people online and this type of thing.
I always stop and I say, show me a verse in the New Testament that says the temple's going to be rebuilt. This is your system. It's not my system. It's your system. Where's the verse?
Or even one about the Jews being returned to that land. I went through it with a fine tooth comb. It's not in there.
Yes. In fact, I did a radio show a number of years ago, and people will say, well, the land promises, haven't been fulfilled yet. And I said, that just isn't the case. The Bible is very clear that all of the promises that were made to Israel regarding the land, and it was a radio show. I think if I can find it here, I think it's in Joshua chapter 21. Yeah, Joshua 21, verse 43. Now, so I'm on the radio and I'm quoting this verse, and we were running out of time. And I said, stay on the line, and then afterwards I'll address this in more detail. So this is what I read to her. This is straight from the Bible. This is Joshua chapter 21, verse 43. So the Lord gave Israel all the land which he had sworn to give to their fathers, and they possessed it and lived in it. He had sworn to their fathers, and their enemies stood before them.
I just lost you for a second there. Do you want to just read that out in its entirety again? I just lost you quite briefly.
Okay, so Joshua chapter 21, verse 43. So the Lord gave Israel all the land which he had sworn to give to their fathers, and they possessed it and lived in it. Verse 44. And the Lord gave them rest on every side, according to all that he had sworn to them. Into the 45. Not one of the good promises which the Lord had made to the house of Israel failed, all came to pass.
Yeah. Yeah, because sometimes they'll accuse us of, they'll accuse us of making God a liar, by saying, oh, well, the Jews haven't, those prophecies haven't been fulfilled,
Some of the commentaries on this particular passage, yeah, it says that, but. And I'm thinking, what am I supposed to do here? What am I supposed to do when I go to Scripture and find something like this and read it and you tell me, yeah, it does say that, but they really weren't fulfilled. And Israel lost the land. That's not God's problem. These promises have always been based on a contingency. You have to be faithful. So you get into the New Testament. How do you be faithful? You can be faithful by embracing Jesus Christ as the promised Messiah, and you don't need a stone temple or animal sacrifices or circumcision. That's all passed away. They were supposed to pass away.
Or a strip of land in the Middle East.
Yeah. Look, and I told Michael Brown, I said, look, I don't have any problem with Israel being in the land in the Middle East, but, don't tell me that this is a fulfillment of Bible prophecy. Why didn't Jesus mention this? Why doesn't Paul mention this? Well, the Old Testament mentions it. Yeah, the Old Testament mentioned it, but Jesus is the fulfillment of all these things. We have, read Hebrews chapter 12. All of this is in terms of the heavenly Zion, Jerusalem above, Galatians chapter 4. I said, well, you don't interpret the Bible literally. Well, I just gave you some verses out of Joshua chapter 21. You don't interpret that literally. You can't find a literal temple mentioned. You can't find literal land mentioned in the New Testament. And all the time texts that we haven't even mentioned yet, don't take that being literal. But Paul, let me just say this. There are more and more people are beginning to question this system. When I started doing this 30 some years ago, it was a real hassle, but today, it's been a wake up call to the church, and more and more people are embracing or not embracing dispensationalism and abandoning it in droves.
good because it's a deception and it doesn't have any basis in basic reality of Christian theology. In fact, I'm actually quite glad that I came to Christianity late. I mean, I was a Catholic, you know, I went, you know, to church and when I was younger and when I got into my 20s and 30s, I suppose I might have went at Easter or whatever else. But I came to read the Bible late, and it was actually by reading it myself in Matthew 24 that I thought, where are these guys getting this from? I mean, Jesus is clearly talking to an audience about a temple, and he's telling them what's going to happen in their generation. So I thought either that generation is still living today, or Jesus was talking about things. Well, because that's the only way you can talk about it. Think about it.
Well, you know, it's funny you bring that up because I can't remember the name of the book, but, you know, there's this passage at the end of John 21, it's verse 18. Truly I say to you, when you were younger, you used to gird yourself and walk wherever you wished. But when you grow old, you will stretch out your hands and someone else will gird you and bring you where you do not wish to go. Now Jesus is talking to Peter. Now this Jesus said, signifying by what kind of death Peter would glorify God. And when he had spoken this, he said to him, follow me. Peter, turning around, saw the disciple whom Jesus loved following them, the one who also had leaned back on his breast at the supper and said, Lord, who is the one who betrays you? Peter, therefore, seeing him, said to Jesus, Lord, and what about this man? Jesus said to him, if I want him to remain until I come, what is that to you? You follow me. Now, this saying, therefore, went out among the brethren that the disciple would not die. Yet Jesus did not say to him he would not die, but only if I want him to remain until I come, what is that to you? And so they see, they read that the word come there, and they see this as coming as the second coming. And in this particular book, this guy actually said there are people out there who believe that the Apostle John is still alive somewhere in a cave somewhere in the world. And so this is the craziness here. Of course, Jesus isn't describing his second coming here. He was describing his coming judgment that took place with the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70, which you and others have finally, you know, caught on. And that's what Matthew 24 and Mark 13 and Luke 21 are all about.
Yeah, to read it any other way, to my mind, is incredibly counterintuitive. I mean, it's quite clear. That's why I'm saying I'm glad that I came to the scriptures later. I just decided, you know, I look back now, before my conversion, before I was born again, which at the time I didn't even know what was going on. It was only afterwards I realized, oh, this is what people call being born again. It didn't happen in a church, by the way. It happened just providentially in 2014. But I'd already been looking at scriptures and theology and stuff like that, and I'd made a conscious effort to read the scriptures. And when I read Matthew 24, I could not understand how anyone thought this was talking about anything beyond that generation, because it's quite clear, which is why I then went online feeling a little bit sort of lonely, I guess, to see if anybody else thought that what I thought. And then I found yourself and I found Steve Gregg, and it made so much more sense, even the millennium. You know, I'm an amillennialist, and I mean, you talk about, you know, the dispensationalists take great pride in thinking that they take everything literally, but they take literally what no intelligent biblical scholar would take literally, a grand cosmic figurative apocalyptic literature and revelation and things like that literally. And then at the start, they don't take that literally. These things that must soon take place. they suddenly depart from the taking literature or taking literally, things that should be taken literally, you know?
Yeah, they put another gap, you know. So yeah, the first three chapters you can take those literally, and then when you get to chapter four, the rapture takes place, and so, you know, prophetic time is suspended, and the chapters 4 through 19 won't start up again until the after the rapture. So, and again, now, you have to import this idea of the rapture again, which again, there's not a single verse in the Bible that says the church is going to be taken off the earth before, during, or after any 7-year period. And here's Paul, here's another thing that a lot of people, you know, I always ask a couple of questions. Which book of the Bible does the word Antichrist appear more than any other book? And a lot of people, well, I guess the book of Revelation, well, the word Antichrist doesn't appear. I ask is, I said, where do you get this 7-year period? And they'll, some of them might know it's Daniel's 70th week, and chapters, the Daniel's 70th week is actually chapters 4 through 19 of the book of Revelation. I said, well, isn't that interesting? Because the book of Revelation uses all kinds of numbers, but it never uses the phrase 7 years. So the book of Revelation is supposed to be about the seven years of Daniel's 70 weeks of years. And yet, the book of Revelation doesn't even use the phrase 7 years. And so, again, this system works because most people don't really understand it well enough and have never really, in terms of its particulars.
Yeah, and unfortunately, it's misplaced trust in either very poor, exegesis from well-meaning leaders or wolves in sheep's clothing, one of the two. But on that note, we'll leave it there. Gary, I'm really glad to have had you on again. As I say, it's been a couple of years, it's been too long. I hope we can do it again soon because there's a real interest in this stuff. It keeps coming up, one way or another.
Oh, yeah, it does. We didn't even get into, Russia and Ukraine.
No.
Which,
yeah. I mean, if you have time over the next month, you know, let's reschedule another one because people love this stuff. And I think it's really important, you know, because, you know, I've got some knowledge in it, but, you know, it's not, I don't spend that much time in it. So it'd be great to have you on again. I'm glad to have refreshed my own mind on some of these things as well. So, I mean, give out where you're mainly to be found at the minute. Obviously, I do promote your book, Last Days Madness. I think that's the most comprehensive work you've done on this type of stuff.
Right. AmericanVision.org is the site where you can get all my stuff, but we are launching a brand new prophecy only website, and it should be up in the next month or so. I've seen most of it. It's almost completed.
What's it called again?
So that'll be devoted it's going to be called Last Days Madness. And that will be available. We'll have a link to it from American Vision. But right now, all you have to do is go to AmericanVision.org. You can find all my books. Unfortunately, if you're overseas, trying to ship things is very expensive. But we have a lot of electronic versions of books that you can download, and also books that are in PDF format that we can make it very, very convenient for you in terms of finding
accessible.
Yeah.
Right, okay. All right. Great. All right. Well, thank you again, Gary. And as I say, we'll hopefully do this again soon. If, you know, I'll contact you within the month and we can get down into talking about, Russia and Ukraine. This will be very, very much, wars of rumors of war stuff and, the Gog and Magog stuff that comes up all the time.
Right.
All right.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much again.
Okay.
You too.